So we're reading the book of Daniel. If you've been here in these last few weeks, then you know that this book is about a group of Jewish lads who are carried off from Jerusalem to Babylon. They've been chosen because they're the brightest, most gifted, most attractive young men in Jerusalem. And the idea is that they're going to spend 3 years training in Babylon, and then they're going to enter the service of the king of Babylon. They're going to become government advisors working for the Babylonian Empire. But first, of course, they've got to be taught the Babylonian way of life. They've got to learn to think like Babylonians. They've got to learn to talk the Babylonian language fluently. They've got to become thoroughly Babylonian in their outlook and their lifestyle and their habits. And above all, they've got to learn to give the king of Babylon the same total, unquestioning loyalty that all the Babylonians give him. In Babylon, the king, Nebuchadnezzar, is treated like a god. People see him as the embodiment of human greatness. They think he's infallible. They worship him. And these Jewish lads have got to learn to think of the king in that way themselves. One of these young men is called Daniel, and he's got three close friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These four lads are only young, probably mid-teens, but they're already very serious, godly, single-minded believers. And they are determined that whatever happens there in Babylon, they are going to remain loyal to the true God, Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of Israel. Oh, man. Yes, they'll take advantage of the opportunity they've got there in Babylon to learn all the useful things that the Babylonians can teach them. They're being offered wonderful educational opportunities, but they're determined that they are not going to compromise with the heathenism, the false religion of Babylon. And especially they are not going to treat the king of Babylon as if he were God. Yes, they'll work hard for him. They see that as their duty. Yes, they'll give him proper honour, because he's the king whom God has put in that position of authority. But the moment that the king's commands clash with God's commands, they will take a stand. And that becomes clear even in chapter 1. Even before they officially start working for the king, as soon as they start their training, the first issue surfaces. Doesn't seem a big issue. Just a matter of what they eat and what they drink. The king wants all the students to eat the food that he provides for them. The only problem is that God, in his book, has said that his people, the Jewish nation, could only eat food that they knew was ritually clean. And that certainly wouldn't have been true for the king's food. So it was a simple matter of, were they going to do what the king wanted them to do, or what God had commanded them to do in his book? Now, to disobey the king, even over a matter like this, could lead to a very short life and a very nasty death. But Daniel and his friends were determined that they weren't going to budge. Regardless of what the king said, they were going to refuse the food and risk the consequences. This, although it may have seemed a minor matter, this really was a crunch issue. Daniel and his friends weren't just being awkward. On some issues, I'm sure they had fallen in line with what the king wanted, even though it was something that they didn't particularly like. And it seems that Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, for example, accepted the fact that they were going to have Babylonian names. They were going to be called Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. All right, it might not be what they would choose, but God had never commanded that his people shouldn't use foreign-sounding names. So on an issue like that, well, they'll fall in line. They'll accept the situation. But when it came to this matter of food and drink, they knew they couldn't compromise, because God had already spoken clearly on that matter in the Bible. Now, as we saw last week, they handled the situation very well. In the end, they never had to get into direct confrontation with the king, because they persuaded a junior official, a guard, to exempt them from the king's command. They didn't eat the food the king had commanded, the food that God had forbidden, and yet God, in his kindness, shielded them from all the consequences that that might have brought. But the important thing was this, that right back there, right at the outset, they had taken their stand. They had made a decision which was going to stand them in good stead for the rest of their lives. Whatever the cost, God's commands come first. What God says is more important than what the most powerful emperor in the world may command. They'd settled that principle in what seemed like a small matter, what they ate, what they drank. But having settled that in their minds at the outset, having acted on it right at the start, it meant they were ready for every other challenge that would come their way in all the years ahead. And we're going to see what some of those challenges were as we read on through the book of Daniel. They met those challenges and they came in those situations. But it all sprang from this first decision that they made right at the outset. Now, it's very often like that in the Christian life. God, in his wisdom, often decrees that when he puts us in a new situation, that very quickly we're faced with a challenge to test us. We're faced with a decision where we've got to settle where our real priorities are. What is really most important to us? And it is so important that we win those early battles. It happens to many people when they're first saved out of the world. Very often the issue is whether the Lord or the family will have first priority. A lad gets saved in his late teens or his early 20s, and he goes back to his non-Christian family. And often, very often, within a matter of weeks, there's some issue where he's put on the spot. Is he going to go along with what the family expects of him, or is he going to keep God's commands? It's his younger brother's 18th birthday. And the whole family are going together to the pictures and then going out for a meal. But he knows that the film they're planning to watch is full of foul language. And it's full of unclean scenes. So he says he can't go. And the family are shocked and they're hurt and they're angry. I don't know how you can do this to your brother. It's his 18th birthday and we've been planning this for months. You knew that. He's accused of disloyalty. And he's accused of having a holier-than-thou attitude. You don't care about this family any longer, do you? Ever since you've taken up with these new friends of yours, you've had no time for your own family. They simply can't accept that his loyalty to God comes before his loyalty to the family. They can't accept that God's commands are now more important to him than the family's wishes. And maybe he asks himself, is it really worth making a stand on this issue? After all, it's only one evening. It's only one film. I mean, his brother only has an 18th birthday once in a lifetime. And he's not going to hear any language in the film that he can't hear at any bus stop in the country. And he can always close his eyes when the steamy scenes start. Is it really worth alienating his family over something so small? Well, what would Daniel say? He'd say, God's commands aren't negotiable. And he'd say that in the long run, it's best to get it clear right at the beginning that God comes before family. If the lad compromises on this one, what will happen? Well, next week there'll be another issue where the family wants him to give in to their wishes. And another the week after that. And another the week after that. And it'll be constant stress. And it'll be constant arguments. Or, in the end, the lad will just finish up in total surrender. Whereas if he stands firm at this point, well, yes, there may be a great row, and there may be a lot of hurt, there may be crying, and there may be upset, and there may be anger, and there may be an estrangement that will go on for a long time. But at least everyone will know that once he has made up his mind, he can't be budged. And the next time round, they won't try to push him in the same way. In the long run, it's likely to be far less painful for him and for the family if things are clearly understood right at the beginning. One short, sharp battle is usually less painful than a long, drawn-out war of attrition, fighting over one issue after another, after another, after another. It's in the providence of God that that lad has been faced with an issue like that right at the beginning of his Christian life, so that he can take a stand, so that he can make it plain to his family once and for all where his priorities are, that he isn't going to budge on any matter where obedience to God is at stake. And it's the same in every situation. You start a new job, and within the first week there will be some issue where you have to take a stand. When the boss says, just tell him the check's in the post. When you know perfectly well it's not, and he knows that you know. Well, then you've got to decide. And again, it's if it's settled then that you are not going to go against God's law, that you're not going to lie for your boss or anyone else, then it will save a lot of trouble in the months ahead. They'll know that that's the man they're dealing with, a man for whom God comes first. From the time that Daniel took his stand, it just meant that everybody who knew him knew where he stood. They knew what his priorities were. The other lads in the group, the officials, the guards, they all knew that there was nothing to be gained by trying to push him, by trying to bully him, by bribing him, by trying to coerce him into going against God's commands. They knew that for him God's law was non-negotiable. And that must have taken the pressure off Daniel and his friends in all sorts of other issues as they arose. Now, what we're going to see this morning is how God honoured the stand that Daniel and his friends took. And I want to show you three ways in which God honoured that stand. Firstly, he gave these lads favour with the king. Secondly, he prolonged their usefulness for many years to come. And thirdly, he enabled them to handle the crisis that no one else could handle. Let's look at those three things then. Firstly, the Lord gave them favour with the king. They've resolved that they're not going to eat the food from the king's table. They're going to stick with vegetables and water, because those are the only things where they can be absolutely sure that they're not unclean. And the chief official is worried. He's worried that that sort of diet will leave them looking unhealthy and run down and emaciated. And he says in chapter 1, verse 10, "Well, why should the king see you looking worse than the other young men your age?" But it doesn't work out that way, does it? They don't become emaciated. Their health doesn't suffer. And we read in verse 15, at the end of the trial period, the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who did eat the royal food. The king liked to have impressive looking people around him. People who look as if they're thriving. And it bolsters his image. And it means that he can take credit for it. It means that people thrive under his patronage. Well, when these four young men come to the end of their course, when they're interviewed by the king, then he's going to be very impressed by these four young men. They look so fit, they look so muscular, they look so handsome. Just in terms of their appearance, they're off to a good start with the king. But more than that, not just physically, but intellectually, God blesses them. We read in verse 17, "To these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds." God gives them success in their academic work, in their intellectual training. Now that isn't something to be taken for granted, because remember that there would be, again, all sorts of matters in their education where they would have had to take an unpopular stand. We're going to see a few verses further down that one big item in Babylonian education was a training in magic and enchantment. Well, I'm perfectly sure from what we've seen already that Daniel and his friends are not going to cooperate at that point. They're not going to say, "Yes, we'll try experiments to bring spirits back from the dead. We'll try magical spells of different sorts, calling on the power of different demons." They're not going to get involved in all those things. And yet, when it comes to the end of their course, their 3 years of training, they're ahead. They're ahead. They're at the top of the class. They qualify in all kinds of literature and learning. But more than that, when then they're taken in to be interviewed by the king himself, who is the chief examiner on the course, then what do we find? We find verse 19, "The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom." They'd not just done well in their studies, they'd had success beyond parallel. They had outstripped all the teachers in the university. Like most kings of his day, Nebuchadnezzar, would have had a circle of men around him who had a reputation for being wise and learned, the most brilliant experts available, his advisors, his counselors. But as the king talks with Daniel and his friends, it's obvious to him that these young men have a grasp of things, they have a wisdom, they have an insight that none of his own super counselors have. These wise men of Babylon, what is their speciality? Well, it says that they are magicians and enchanters, verse 20. They would have said that they got their insight into situations through magical power. Well, Daniel and his friends have refused to go down that road. They've refused to study those courses. They've refused to go to the sessions where the spells are being cast, where demons are being worshipped. And Daniel and his friends don't claim to have any magical powers. They don't claim to be able to read the future from the stars or to conjure up the dead to tell them what to do. And yet Daniel and his friends have obviously got a wisdom that outshines all the wisdom of the experts, the magicians, the astrologers, the necromancers of Babylon. The king examines these four young men and he says, I've never met young men like this. I've never met anybody like these young men. They're only very young. They may not even be out of their teens yet. And yet he finds in them a wisdom that is, we're told, 10 times greater than that of the most learned men in the kingdom, the men who have gone down all the approved lines, the men who have studied the real prestige subjects. Daniel and his friends outshine them all. That is God's way of honouring these four young men and the stand they've taken. They've refused to compromise. They've put God first consistently. They've said that his law will rule every action they take, every choice they make. They've been prepared to put their lives on the line for that. And now God says, right, I'm going to vindicate them before men. I'm going to make sure that they win the king's favour, that even the pagan king of Babylon will have to acknowledge that they are something very special. Now, I have to say this, that it isn't always like that for a Christian. It doesn't always work out that way. If it did, then there would be no real challenge for us at all. If it did always work out in that way, obedience would never be costly. There would never really be any test of faith. If every Christian knew that every time he took a costly decision, that there would come some wonderful vindication from God, some marvellous reward, well, doing God's will would simply be a matter of a wise investment. I know I'm going to get back more than I lose. You know, sometime within the next couple of years, sometime within the next 5 years, I'm not really going to lose anything. You know, if every time a man turned down a job because it meant losing touch with the church, if every time a man did that, he was immediately rewarded with a better job, then he wouldn't be turning down the job for God's sake. He'd be turning it down for the sake of the better job that he was sure was on the way. If every student who refused to revise on Sundays got a first, then very soon Christian students would learn, Well, the way to get firsts is by refusing to revise on Sundays. And there'd be no sacrifice at all in keeping God's law. If every girl working in an office who stood up and said, "No, I will not lie," knew that she was then going to be promoted to a higher post in the company, well then, she'd have an incentive to stand up in that way. An incentive not of, "I want to please God, but I want a better post." God doesn't guarantee that there'll be this sort of vindication here in this world. Because otherwise obeying God would just become a sort of commercial investment. I might lose 10% initially, but there'll be a return on my investment of 100% within the year. And yet God can and does do this at times. This is a lovely example in the Bible of God honouring the stand of his children, vindicating them publicly. There are times when somebody does turn down a job because it would mean losing touch with the church, and God does reward them with a better job. There are students who refuse to revise on Sundays and who do get the first, which nobody expects. There are times when God does step in. There are times when an Olympic athlete refuses to run on a Sunday and forfeits what people regard as a certain medal, and then unexpectedly is invited to run an event that isn't his event and breaks the world record. It does happen, because God does take a delight vindicating his own children. The Bible says that God sits in the heaven and laughs. I think there are times when God laughs with delight as he takes his child, whom everybody has written off because of their costly obedience, and unexpectedly puts them into the position that nobody expected them to enjoy. God did that for these men. He gave them favour with the king. And then the second thing that God did for these men, or at least we know for Daniel, he prolonged Daniel's usefulness for many years to come. Daniel made a decision that could have led to him losing his head. He was willing to risk his life in order to keep God's commands. And yet we read in chapter 1 and verse 21 these words: "And Daniel remained there in Babylon with the favour of the king until the first year of King Cyrus." Daniel was taken off from Jerusalem to Babylon in the year 605 BC. Cyrus the Persian came to power in the year 539 BC. 66 years. And all through those 66 years, Daniel was there, serving God in that place. Daniel outlived Babylon. Here's the Babylonian king who says, "I've got power over life and death." Daniel outlived Nebuchadnezzar. He outlived Nebuchadnezzar's empire. He outlived all Nebuchadnezzar's wise men. At the end of 66 years, he was still there in position, doing the work that God had called him to do. Immortal till his work had been done. It was in the first year of King Cyrus that Cyrus issued a decree saying that the Jews could go back from exile, back to their own land, that they could go back and rebuild Jerusalem. That's what Daniel waited for all down through the years. That's what he prayed for all down through the years. That's what he prepared other people for down through the years. The year, the day when God's people would be able to go back from Babylon to Jerusalem. And he lived to see that day. God kept him alive until that day when Cyrus sent out his decree and said, anyone who wants to go back and rebuild Jerusalem can do. You know, for people living in Babylon, they would have said, Daniel, who's he? You know, the way he's going on, clinging to this sort of obsolete philosophy of his, the way he's going on, sort of obsessed with some old book that these Jewish people seem to think is important, you know, a book written hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Who's Daniel? He doesn't belong in the modern world. And then they would have looked at the great buildings of Babylon and they said, this is what counts. This great empire. This is where the future lies. They'd have looked at the wise men of Babylon and they said, these are the men who really know what it's all about. They'd have looked at Nebuchadnezzar and they'd have said, if you really want some guarantees for the future, you make sure that you're in good standing with Nebuchadnezzar. They thought that this world was permanent. They thought this world was what lasted, what had lasting value. And yet Daniel was still there 66 years later, when the tide of history had swept Babylon away, had swept away all its wise men. And 2,500 years later, we're still reading about Daniel. And we're going to go on reading about his prophecies. We're going to go on reading the words he said about the Lord Jesus who would come. We don't know. Hands up, those of you who have ever read a word written by the magicians and enchanters and experts, the pundits of Babylon. They were swept away. Been forgotten. Babylon itself lost under the sands of Iraq. And yet Daniel's words, what God taught him, still resounding down through the century, still feeding human souls, still bringing people to Christ, still leading people into everlasting life. That's how God vindicated Daniel. He gave him not just 66 more years of usefulness, but he's given him a place in the eternal plan. He's given him, he gave him work to do, the value of which will go on for all eternity. Every single one of you here who is a Christian can do work that will last for eternity. That's the high and lofty destiny to which you've been called. That every single little thing you do for Jesus Christ, every single little act of obedience, will ring on and on and on through eternity, bringing him everlasting glory and bringing you everlasting joy. Who'd have imagined it? That Daniel's refusal to eat a pork chop would have everlasting consequences. And yet it did, and it does. Who'd have believed that your refusal to lie for the boss, or your refusal to revise on a Sunday, can go on resounding down through the centuries and resounding all through eternity? But that's what we learn here. God gives Daniel a permanence. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Everything of this world passes. Only what's done for Jesus will last. But everything that's done for Jesus will last. Every single thing we do for Jesus Christ is remembered in the annals of heaven and brings Jesus everlasting joy and is used by Jesus for his everlasting glory. I had my third point, didn't I? I think it's going to have to wait for next week. My third point was this, that he enabled these four young men to handle the crisis that no one else could handle. We'll talk about that next week, the story that unfolds in chapter 2, how helpless the world is when a crisis develops for which they've got no answers, and how God uses Daniel and his friends then to speak into that crisis, to bring God's wisdom into that crisis, to bring the answers that nobody else can find. The world couldn't even understand what the problem was, let alone giving the answers. But Daniel and his friends, with the wisdom given to them by God, will bring the answers that no one else can find. But I've said enough this morning.